Tom. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The dearth of affordable housing and homelessness are actually two sides of the same coin. But today we look at a slightly different kind of homelessness in the second part of the show and begin with the enormous problem of finding affordable housing for folks. Every year, people apply to the federal government for affordable housing vouchers. This year in Charlotte, 32,128 people applied for those vouchers. The government handed out 400. That leaves an enormous number of people out in the cold, but we're about to meet some individuals working on this deficit. Fulton Meacham Jr. is the CEO of the Charlotte Housing Authority, which is considered to be one of the most progressive housing authorities in the nation. Why is that the case?
We kind of think outside the box. We really are out here trying to make a difference in people's lives by not just housing, but also supportive services that wrap around them as well. We look at it as kind of a three-legged stool from the standpoint of the providing housing, providing supportive services, as well as providing the subsidies in which you just got through speaking about as far as the Housing Choice Voucher Program.
Well, welcome to the program. Jim Prosser is also here. He's the executive director of the Centralina Council of Governments, which represents the nine-county Charlotte region, which gives you an indication of how of the scope of this problem that we're talking about today. And Deronda Metz is Director of Social Services for the Salvation Army of Greater Charlotte, which covers portions of North and South Carolina. And she also oversees the Center of Hope Emergency Shelter here with more than 6,000 annual admissions, making it the largest emergency shelter for women and children in the Southeast. That's a dubious honor, isn't it? If on average more than 32,000 residents apply to the federal government for affordable housing vouchers and only 400 get them, why even bother to have the vouchers?
It's so important, I think, to have that opportunity for families to have affordable housing. Our last time we opened up the waiting list, we had 12,000 individuals that applied. We just extinguished that waiting list, and we still had 142 people that were left from 7 years ago that were still looking for housing. So they, in some cases, you have to be very patient in order to get affordable housing because there's just not an adequate supply. And this opportunity puts them in line, if you will, for an extremely quality form of life in housing.
Is this a perennial? This is a perennial problem. It's been going on for years.
Yes.
In this city and other cities around the country. Is it growing because the number of people in need of affordable housing is growing? Is it growing because the stock of workforce affordable housing is in stasis or declining? Or is it because funding has declined for these vouchers?
Yes, to all three of those. The fact of the matter is, we're seeing and projecting that we're going to continue to see a need for housing that meets the affordability criteria for people across the region. And it's really important to note that we're talking about people with jobs, and we're also talking about seniors. That's a big growth area, is the fact that we've got seniors and people with disabilities that are going to need housing, that simply there is simply not housing stock within this region, sufficient supply of housing stock to meet those needs. And that growth is going to continue, and it's not going to all be within the city of Charlotte. It's going to be across the region. The growth is a little stronger here in terms of what the need is. But if you look across the region, we're going to need over the next 40 years, we're going to need at least another 30,000 housing units outside of Charlotte alone. Including Charlotte, will be 72,000.
And what's the likelihood of actually achieving that?
Well, we're pretty optimistic that we have to we're going to do things differently through partnerships, for example, with Salvation Army and the Charlotte Housing Authority and a lot of other non-for-profits and private sector. We've already begun to lay some groundwork for strategies that will help us begin to make a dent into these numbers. But we have to do that because the neighborhoods that our families grow in really have a big impact upon their ability to be productive, to be be part of society in a positive way. We need to make sure that there's accessibility for housing across the region.
And that 72,000, I think that was the number you threw out there, is what we'll need by, 2050, I think
that's
you said?
That's correct. Right.
That's a projection, and I'm wondering if projections can be met, because I'm told that 32,000, the number of people who need the vouchers right now,
right.
32,000 is three times the number of people who applied for vouchers just 7 years ago. That's a 200% increase in just 7 years. So with demand rising that quickly, is 72,000 a realistic number, or should it be higher?
I think that number, from the research that we've done, is the correct number. And I think, again, as we talked about before, as Jim talked about, the partnerships that we're bringing to the table, I think, is the way that we're going to be able to meet that need. It won't simply be the construction of 72,000 units, but it will be a combination of also supportive services that we're providing residents to keep them from actually having to need this type of housing, as well as the subsidies in which, through the Housing Choice Voucher Program, the Away Home program that's out here now as well, the city's housing trust fund dollars that'll be on the ballot this year, $15 million worth of that to build more housing opportunities out here for families. It's going to be a combination of all of those things, I think, in order to meet this overall need, mm-hmm. and not nonetheless to say that I think the private sector has to be brought in as well to find some ways in which all the new development that's going on within the city, whether it's uptown or around town, that we find a way to build in some affordability within it as well. I mean, the populations in which we're talking about are the working families of our community, and it would be a shame for them not to have the opportunity to live with inside Charlotte and have to live in other counties.
The Charlotte Housing Authority offers support to about, 22,000?
22,000 Charlottesians, yes.
With subsidies and through the Housing Choice Voucher Program. Are those 22,000 part of the 32,000 that we spoke of earlier, or are they separate from those?
That's a separate number.
So there's really more like 50-some thousand people in need of housing vouchers.
Well, I'm saying, well, the people, the 22,000 are housed presently.
Right.
Okay, and so the 32,000 are presently not housed. And so that number is the number of people that actually signed up on the waiting list. And I want to make sure I said signed up on the waiting list. The waiting list was open for 5 days, 24 hours a day, and it was an online process. And through that process, we received 32,000. My assumption would be if we would have left it open for a month, we would have had more than that number as well. And so the key for us, I think, is one, understanding that this was a benchmark, I think, now to talk about what is the true need within Charlotte and in the surrounding area. And more importantly, who are those individuals?
Yeah.
We're talking about 4,400 homeless families with children. We know that there are about 4,000 homeless children in our community. And we're talking about veterans, the people in which give their life and limb for our liberties. And we're also talking about working families, which about 16,000 of these individuals, which was a number that I guess kind of shocked me a little bit from the standpoint of we have working families out here every single day that really are struggling. And they need a subsidy in order to have a quality of life mm-hmm. that anybody would want. And in our program, we're also able to diversify, if you will, or make sure that housing is spread out across the actual Charlotte and Mecklenburg County in the Housing Choice Voucher Program. So they have options and choices to live in communities where they have excellent schools or amenities that are around them that meet their needs in the Housing Choice Voucher Program, which makes it a great program.
Deronda Metz, you're the Director of Social Services for the Salvation Army of Greater Charlotte. So how many people do you see? How many people come to you on an annual basis for help? And who are these people?
So we serve on an annual basis for the first time about 3,000 women and children every day. A big part of our role here in the Charlotte community is making sure homeless families are not on the street. It's not an easy job. This has been the toughest year because this year we spend more time turning people away. Mm. Another big part of our job is getting people out into affordable housing, also a challenge. So we were able to get at least 800 people into housing last year. Some people leave on their own. Now, who do we serve? We serve veteran families. We actually have a veterans program. I did not even know that it was that many homeless vets with children. When the VA approached us and asked us to contract with them to serve veteran families, I thought, veterans and their children are homeless, and they are. We also serve people that are working, and we serve the generational homeless, people that I've been there 25 years, and, you know, unfortunately see children come back as adults. We serve the communities, mainly people that have mental health challenges. Basically, we serve people that are homeless and need our services.
And you're just one of many non-governmental organizations involved in serving the homeless. So when you turn somebody away because you simply have no more room, do you send them to one of these other agencies, or do you just send them on their way and hope for the best?
Yeah, unfortunately, we are predominantly the only emergency shelter here in Charlotte. So we're sort of the last stop. So a tough, tough challenge for us is to say we don't have space. And the next question is, where do I go? And it's call back tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we have to be really, really diligent about is making sure that people don't have any other options. So if you fall out with your family member, go back and make up with your family member. We want to save our beds for those people that desperately need them.
Mm-hmm.
We now have a new coordinated assessment system. This is great for our community because where we had people entering homeless programs from various parts, and now we have a system where we can actually work on addressing it in a systemic way.
You're talking about what United Way announced just weeks before this enormous number of 32,000 was announced. The United Way said they're starting a new coordinated assessment system in which all housing charities work together to figure out how to help people who are struggling to maintain stable housing. What's the Salvation Army's role in that program?
So we are actually one of four assessment sites. So if you find yourself homeless in Charlotte, you can come to the Salvation Army, Crisis Assistance Ministries, the Men's Shelter of Charlotte, or Urban Ministries. So our role is to make sure that we keep the doors open. So if you get there after hours and we have a bed available, you still may be able to stay. But that's a big part of what we're doing.
The enormous growth in 7 years of people who need these housing vouchers for affordable housing, I'm told, caught a lot of officials off guard. And I also understand that of the 32,000 people who applied, nearly 4,500 of them identified themselves as being homeless. They don't just need housing. They have no housing. This is not just happening in Charlotte. It's happening all over the country and certainly throughout the region that the Central Atlantic Council of Government serves. So how has your organization, Jim Prosser, been working to solve this problem?
The most important first steps that we've taken include identifying and getting a better handle on the magnitude of the problem that we have now, as well going in the future. And if you take a look across the region, if you look at owner and rental properties that we need to provide housing for those folks that are earning 50% or less of the median income. And just to give you an idea, we're talking about, for a family of two, that's about $30,000. So we're looking at over 200,000 housing units that currently need to be provided, and that's going to continue to grow. But the second thing that we're looking at after we look at that projection of what the need will be is looking at what the partnerships are. We've mentioned earlier the work that Salvation Army and Charlotte Housing Authority are doing. We have to expand that across the region, and we have to bring in private sector partners. So we're working with National Association of Realtors. We're working with REBEC, Home Builders Association. And we're looking to develop really partnerships, private public partnerships, to work within each of the communities across the region to establish those strategies to meet these needs.
I'm going to find out how difficult that is to do when we come back. Among other things, we're talking with Jim Prosser, Executive Director of the Central Atlantic Council of Governments, Deronda Metz, Director of Social Services for the Salvation Army, and Fulton Meacham, CEO of the Charlotte Housing Authority. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts. Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella is the Broadway musical with a contemporary take on a classic tale. November 4th through 9th at Belk Theater. Tickets available at blumenthalarts.org. And Monarch Mental Health and Human Services, with an emphasis on putting the care into mental health care. Details at monarchnc.org/cares. But when it comes to charities, most of us believe those that funnel the most money into the cause with minimal overhead are the best charities. But is that really true? Our guest tomorrow says maybe not. He says that kind of thinking undermines the causes the charities support. And if that sounds puzzling to you, we'll get an explanation of it tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, some states are instituting mandatory quarantines for health workers who've treated Ebola patients in West Africa. Debate over the legal, ethical, and public health effects of quarantines for Ebola.
That's the Diane Rehm Show, coming up next from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
We're talking about homelessness today here on Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking about two different sides of the same coin in a way. We're talking about the general overall need for affordable housing, workforce housing, and the dearth of it in this area. And a little bit later on in the program, we'll talk about a different kind of homelessness, LGBT youth who have been shown the door by their parents and what they have to do to find places to live, to stay. You have said, Deronda, that – well, before I go to you, Deronda, let me go back to Jim Prosser here with the Central Council of Governments, because you talked just before the break about getting cooperation from public-private partnerships to make this housing available. How difficult is it to get people on board and to get corporations on board and to get other entities on board that could help solve this issue?
Certainly it's challenging, but what we're experiencing here, and I want to thank especially Fulton for his leadership, because he's leading a group with a private sector partner, Joe Padilla, with Rebec. Once we clearly articulate the challenge and the opportunity, really we're seeing some really good collaboration in this region, and Charlotte's really known for that, their ability to pull people together. The other part of this that's really challenging, however, is the need to really make sure that we're clearly communicating across the region and to the state as well as federal government that these partnerships exist. We're ready to use existing organizations to really accelerate solving some of these problems. But the private sector wants to work with government. They really do. They want to work in collaboration. And we're finding that that's easier going to get those strategies. What's tougher is getting the resources, because businesses need to make a profit, and organizations like Fulton's and Salvation Army, they need revenue capital to work with as well. So that's the big challenge right now.
This number of people, this 32,000 plus the 22,000 that the Housing Authority already helps, is a large number of people, and it's a growing number of people, and we talked about that in the last segment. It's growing really, really, really fast. And Deronda, you have said that we've always had this problem, but that more and more people who are not homeless are trying to get help from the system. People struggling to stay in their homes are desperate, you say, and you go on to say that charities in Charlotte do not have the resources to help. Why is this rising number of people who are hanging on by their fingernails? What is it telling you that we have all these people hanging on, just hanging on?
Well, for one thing, I mean, the cost of rents have increased so much. You know, I remember when we first rolled out a program, what we call Rapid Rehousing, just 2 years ago, it was so much easier for us to find a unit that someone could sustain and support themselves after about 3 months.
Was that because we were in recession and people were looking for people to rent anything that they could rent?
Absolutely.
Now that we're out of recession, it's becoming scarcer and rents are rising?
Absolutely. And that's creating a huge challenge for people that are homeless and for people who we call them precariously housed. They're housed somewhere, but they're just struggling to be able to pay the rents. And I didn't mean to sound cold about we don't have the resources to help those people that are not literally homeless. But the reality of it is that we have a small amount of resources to help those that are truly homeless. And so we're trying to target those resources. It will be the only way that we can actually end homelessness.
Mm-hmm. That supply and demand issue is really important, because we had an oversupply of housing for a while, but that's been quickly absorbed.
You just said that's the only way we could end homeless, and I'm wondering if that's true. Because as I sit here and have this conversation today, and we've had other conversations about this problem and ancillary problems, Is anybody addressing the income problem? I mean, if people can't afford housing, it's not only because the rent's too high, it's because they don't make enough money.
There's no question that a living wage has to be looked at as a part of this. We talked about the 16,000 individuals that are the working poor presently.
But is anybody working on that? How do you work on that? How do you go to a McDonald's or a Burger King or anybody else who's employing people and say, you know, you don't pay enough?
So we have a partnership with the Housing Authority in a project called SHIP. It's 60 apartments in a 214 apartment complex.
What is SHIP an acronym for, by the way?
SHIP is an acronym for Supportive Housing Innovative Project. Okay. And it's just that. So for 60 families, they get an opportunity to go back to school. Their rent has been subsidized through what they call Section 9, which is a public housing unit. And it was an opportunity. It's an opportunity for families to get out of poverty. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are many, many more families we can serve, but this is huge because this project is unique. I don't know of any other project across the country that's given families an opportunity to go to school. We could not have done it without the partnership of the Housing Authority. And then we have Mecklenburg County on board that's helping us to provide the services such as child care, giving people an opportunity to get out of poverty. So we are doing some of it. I wish we could do more.
I was going to say, this is one of the projects that you pointed to earlier in the conversation about why you are considered one of the more progressive housing authorities in the country, because you're giving people options to not need you anymore.
And that's a key. I think we have, and I just want to make sure you know, we have 5,000 families right now in the Housing Choice Voucher program. When you combine both the Section 8 program and our public housing program, you're talking about roughly 10,000 families. But that's only 2.5% of this particular city. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what we're talking about here is that we need to expand that a little bit and talk about the partnerships in which we have. We've named some of them, but I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the city and their real commitment to providing affordable housing. The Housing Trust Fund has done so much for the Charlotte Housing Authority in its ability to build units. Mm-hmm. It's done a lot for the homeless community from the standpoint of being able to build homeless shelters as well. So we're really committed in this city to build partnerships. The Foundation of the Carolinas is another great partner that we have in this city that is really diving in on this issue of affordable housing, not just affordable housing, but upward mobility issues. And I really feel with the partnerships in which we have, we're going in the right direction.
I want to go back to this coordinated assessment system, which the United Way announced a little while ago. And according to the Charlotte Observer, 85% of the 448 people who used the coordinated assessment were qualified for a housing program, but only 4.5% of those 448 people got the help they needed. Why did only 448 people, if the need is so great, why did only 448 people use coordinated assessment? And if only 4.5% get the help they need, what happens to those who don't get the help they need?
Yeah, well, you know, unfortunately, a lot of those households that did not get the help are still in the shelters or on the street. And so just to address
it. Why did so few apply?
You had to be literally homeless, meaning you had to be on the street or you had to be in a shelter in 72 hours. So we still have, for an example, the 4,000 children that are homeless in Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools. They may be living doubled up with a family or friends. So that group of individuals were not eligible to come through coordinated assessment. Coordinated assessment is narrow. It's just for those individuals that are literally homeless, meaning that you have some type of verification that you're living on the street, or that you've been exited from wherever you are within 72 hours.
You also are the director of the Center of Hope for the Salvation Army, and you'll be adding, I'm told, 64 beds, which will increase your capacity to 334 beds. As nice as that may be, isn't that like a raindrop in the ocean when we're talking about the numbers that we're talking about here?
Yeah, it is. But one of the things that we're trying to do as a city, as a community across the country, is we're trying to get away from building shelter. Mm-hmm. So what we did, instead of us adding on, which we were going to have a hard time getting support from the city to do, we decided to add a floor in our attic space. And the city Housing Trust Fund and private sector supported us tremendously. The other part we're trying to do is trying to build up our resources where we can get people out of the shelter quickly. Therefore, we're going to have to continue to add beds.
The Central Atlanta Council of Governments is, what, a 9-county area. So is the county, is the need greatest in Mecklenburg because we're the most populous county? Or when you break the numbers down by percentages, by per capita, is it pretty much the same across the region that you serve, Jim?
Relatively, it is. It's a little bit more in the Charlotte area, but overall, there's a need throughout the region, and that really concerns us because there are not as many resources available outside of Charlotte-Mecklenburg.
One of you mentioned veterans. Veterans figure evidently pretty well into this figure, unfortunately. Who are these veterans? Are these young men and women coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, or are they from previous conflicts, or are they just veterans who served, maybe never left the States? Who are these people?
All three.
All three.
Yeah, all three. We serve, I know in our veterans program, veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, some that have never been served, never left the States. All of them.
We have 243 VASH vouchers, and those are vouchers specifically for veterans, and they range from Vietnam to Iraq.
The Charlotte Housing Authority has predicted that none of the 32,128 applicants who needed housing vouchers will get help this year. If that's an accurate statement, what happens to those people?
Well, let me define that. The issue is that 32,000 individuals need to be contacted, and we need to make sure that they're treated very specially because we want to make sure they have – we send information out in the email, we send information out in the mail to make sure that they know where they are on the waiting list, and 32,000 is going to take some time to do so. But we feel like they'll be engaged and that process will start so that early next year, they'll be actually able to receive housing.
What should listeners of this conversation take away from what they just heard?
Well, one of the things I think they should take away from is that, one, there is a significant need for affordable housing within the city of Charlotte and as well this region, and that all of us working together, we have a civic, I think, responsibility to provide housing for the people that are the most needy, our homeless families, our veterans, and our working families and our seniors. And I think working together on those things that we can close this gap.
I think the other part is that the faces of the people that need the housing are very familiar to us. They're the people throughout our communities that are working in our schools, in our cities, in our businesses throughout this region, and our seniors and our families. These are people that live here now that have real needs that have just come under unfortunate circumstances and are caught in a difficult situation.
Jim Prosser is Executive Director of the Central Atlanta Council of Governments. Deronda Metz, Director of Social Services for the Salvation Army of Greater Charlotte. And Fulton Meacham, CEO of the Charlotte Housing Authority. Thank you all for the time. I appreciate it. Now on to the problem of homelessness, but with a twist. When we think of the homeless, it is people who have fallen on economic hard times, just the ones we just mentioned that come to mind, or people with substance abuse or mental problems. We don't think, usually, of young people who would not be homeless were it not for the fact that their parents, to put it bluntly, kicked them out of their homes. That sad occurrence happens for a variety of reasons, but there seems to be a rising number of homeless gay teens on the streets who have been cast out of their homes by parents who take issue with their child's sexual orientation. Some estimates say that 40% of homeless youth are LGBTQ kids. And here to talk about the problem and some local solutions are Brendan Graham, Francisco White, and Sharika Clark. Brendan Graham is Executive Director of The Relatives. That's a shelter providing support to more than 3,000 runaway and homeless young people every year. Welcome back. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Francisco White is the peer navigator in the Empowering Positive Youth Program at the Regional AIDS Interfaith Network, better known to many as RAIN. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Sharika Clark is Director of Youth Services at Time Out Youth, which for more than 20 years has offered support, advocacy, and opportunities for personal development and social interaction to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and questioning young people between the ages of 11 and 20. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Welcome. Given the advances that gay people have made in recent years in terms of equality, the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, now the right to marry in many states, people may be surprised that parents are asking their gay children to leave once they announce their orientation. How big a problem is this? I'm not sure which one of you to ask that question of, but take a stab at it, Chirica.
I think the number one reason why kids are displaced from their home is obviously family rejection. They're not so comfortable with their sexual orientation and gender identity.
The families aren't. The parents
correct,
aren't.
Correct. It could be from a religious standpoint, or it could be from, you know, a mom wants her kid to be married to a husband and have children and things
this,
of that
is
nature.
Is this problem increasing, or is it pretty much the same? It's been the same for years. When a child announces that they are gay, they maybe the family has a problem with it, or is it increasing now?
I think it's it's getting better with the pass of that we're allowed to get married now. I think in the older generations, the parents were more accustomed to religion. And more so now, the younger adults that are having kids, they're more so open to sexual orientation and gender identity.
Well, you've mentioned religion twice, and religion seems to be a big part of this problem because, and this is not meant to be a judgment, it's simply that people raised with a certain value system have a really tough time with this whole idea of homosexuality. And when their child presents that, they just can't deal with it. So how big a problem is religion?
From what we've seen at the relatives, that is one of the main issues. For me, I guess for a personal standpoint, it's about the child's safety. So regardless of your beliefs, regardless of anything else that will really compromise your ability to accept your child, your child has to be safe. And so, you know, we've had situations where a mother would kick her 15-year-old child out of the house because she says she's gay. You can't be gay here. But she's a 15-year-old girl now out on the street having to do whatever she can to survive because mom doesn't accept her. Mm-hmm. And so it's really about, for us, it's about safety. No judgment whatsoever. It's about the safety of the young people.
Francisca, you say that this city, like other major cities, has a youth homelessness problem that disproportionately affects LGBTQ young people. And given that federal funding for homelessness generally focuses on adults, not children, does that make things even harder for LGBTQ kids on the streets?
Absolutely. I think you said it very kindly earlier when you said that there is this, these parents are having a tough time accepting their child's gender identity or sexuality. And it's more like a refusal to accept. And I think that that is largely based in religion. We're in the Bible Belt. This is Charlotte, North Carolina. Religion is a major factor in why these kids are on the streets and don't have the adequate resources to meet their needs. It's like a nationwide epidemic of family rejection and neglect, and I think Charlotte is a microcosm of that. So,
well, you're with RAIN, the Carolina Regional AIDS Interfaith Network, and one of the problems that we've talked about in past programs with RAIN and other organizations is that the HIV epidemic, which is separate from the LGBTQ homelessness problem, it's worse in southern states, it's worse in the Bible Belt, and a large part of that has to do with the reluctance of religious organizations to grab a hold of this issue.
Absolutely. I mean, the issues are connected, really. Charlotte is number 14 among metropolitan areas nationwide for the rate of HIV transmission. Of course, people of color are disproportionately impacted. Young men of color are disproportionately impacted. And furthermore, young gay men of color are disproportionately impacted. And what we see with the LGBTQ youth homelessness crisis is that young black gay men of color are disproportionately impacted. So it's really an issue of interconnection.
We're going to come back and talk more about this problem after we come back from the break. So stay with the Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Theater Charlotte, presenting To Kill a Mockingbird, the trial and conviction of an innocent black man reveal an ugly side of a poor southern community. Now through November the 8th, tickets at carolinatix.org, and Ferguson Bath Kitchen and Lighting Gallery, featuring the latest for the kitchen and bath, including hands-free faucets by Moen. The Motion Sense faucets include two advanced sensors to set water in motion. Locations at ferguson.com. Some states are instituting mandatory quarantines for health workers who have treated Ebola patients in West Africa. Diane Raymond, her guest, will look at the debate over the legal, ethical, and public health effects of quarantines for Ebola coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Raymond Show. When we come back, we are going to be talking again about LGBT youth in Charlotte who are homeless because their parents showed them the door. We're coming right back.
All Things Considered is your front row seat behind the headlines. Learn about the day's events and what happened while you were at work. Listen weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 to All Things Considered from NPR and WFAE. Find out not only what happened, but why through the in-depth reporting of our news teams in Charlotte and around the world. Listen to All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on Charlotte's NPR news source, WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHEI. Mike Collins. We're talking about homeless LGBT children on the streets of Charlotte and around the country. It's a nationwide problem with Francisco White, Empowering Positive Youth peer navigator with the Carolina Regional AIDS Interfaith Network. Sharika Clark is director of youth services at Time Out Youth, which is an organization that for 20 years has been serving LGBT young people. And Q, too many letters to keep track of now. Brennan Graham is executive director of The Relatives, which handles problems with runaways and homeless kids of all stripes. Francisco, you have said that LGBTQ young people are not adequately served by the current local shelter system. Why?
I'm not sure if it's like systemic ignorance or institutional homophobia or transphobia. It's just a general unwillingness to meet the need. And I think it's because people don't want to face the fact that it exists here in Charlotte.
Now, these kids actually actively turned away. And if they're actively turned away, are they turned away because of their identification of their sexual orientation? What's the story there?
Well, in my personal experience, I've had clients turned away from the women's shelter, trans female clients turned away from the women's shelter because they were not assigned the female gender at birth. So we have issues like that. We have male to female transgender individuals being sent to the men's shelter where they're obviously going to face tremendous risk of sexual assault or physical violence.
And one young man that you spoke with was critical of this city's approach to dealing with the homeless. He said, and I'm quoting here, "I find it hard to navigate the different organizations because of their umbrella or catch-all approach. There seems to be a more individualized, there needs to be a more individualized approach to helping young people. I just need stability," he said. I need stability that does not stifle. I need stability that does not just tolerate me. I need genuine help, not just because it's someone's job, but because I'm just, or because I'm just another number on the list." Is that how kids are treated?
That's absolutely how they're treated in Charlotte. And I feel like that was like the most eye-opening conversation I've had about this issue in this city. The issue with the resources that are available to LGBTQ homeless youth in the city is that a lot of them are religion or church-based themselves. So when you've been turned away from your home because of religious and faith reasons, the last place that you want to seek help is a faith-based institution. So I think that we have to overcome that. I think we have to step outside of our comfort zone and come together as a community and form partnerships that have absolutely nothing to do with the church. That needs to be an option for these kids.
Younger people, Shakira, appear to be more open about their sexual orientation. I'm told that people didn't used to come out, if they came out at all, till well after college. And now kids are coming out at 15, yeah. 14, 16 years old. Is that actually working to increase the problem? Because suddenly they're still living in their parents' house, or will be until the parents say out. They would have made it through high school and probably college had they not told their parents, right?
I think both. I think it does help and it doesn't. I think I know when I was a part of the community, I opened up to my parents when I was just getting out of college, just for the fear of my mother because she was very religious. But nowadays, kids are coming out in the ninth grade and eighth grade, more so because of GSAs. GSAs are gay straight alliance groups that are catered to kids that are having trouble, are being bullied within the school system or outside the school system, and it helps them. So I think opening up at the age of 15 or 14, it doesn't really matter. I think because of the GSA network, I think it's helping the youth, and I don't think it's an issue for them being homeless. I don't think that's like the number one reason why. coming out earlier.
The Relatives is, we've done a show on your organization. The Relatives is an organization that deals primarily with runaway kids who are having problems at home, and you work to help them solve those problems so that they can then go back home to be with their parents. You are not meant to be a permanent, full-time, live here for the rest of your teenage life shelter. You're a stopping point on a road back home, essentially.
Right.
How many of the kids that you deal with come to you because of this? They've been asked to leave their house because of their orientation.
Each year in our program, we have close to 300 kids coming in who need to stay overnight. And about half of them have been either kicked out of their homes, asked to leave, or have run away from home, and the parents knew they were leaving and didn't really care. And I don't have the exact numbers, but a high number of those kids have had family conflicts stemming from their sexual identity or sexual orientation.
So in that situation where you have parents who have fundamental problems with their child's sexual orientation, be it religious-based or some other reason, how successful are you in reuniting these young people with their parents and to getting them back into their homes?
I think we're very successful. About 80% of the kids who come to our program are reunited with their families.
Why are you successful? What do you say? What's the magic bullet here?
We work with the entire family. So when a young person comes to our program, we bring the family in to see what we can do to develop a plan to help them stay safe in the future. And then we follow up for up to a year and many times longer than that. But if they need to come back,
if mom and dad have a religious objection to their child being gay or trans or whatever it may be, how do you get beyond that point?
Well, it goes back to what I said before about the safety. You have a responsibility to keep your child safe. And so as a parent, and we really have to make sure that the parents understand that the community is not going to take care of your child if you really need to. And parents love their kids. They just don't necessarily love the things that they're explaining.
So what's it like for a child to go back into a home where they're simply tolerating them because they do feel an obligation to keep them safe, even though they hate everything about what they stand for? What's it like for that child?
Well, it's about the support that we offer throughout that whole period. So it's continuous support with the kids and the families to make sure that it's not just tolerating the kids, but accepting the kids for who they are and making sure that they can continue to provide the love and support.
And what happens to the kids who fall through the cracks, who you and other organizations are not successful in getting their parents to reopen their doors to them?
Unfortunately, many of those kids are either continue to be homeless or on the road to homelessness as adults over the age of 18.
Is it more difficult to be a homeless gay child than it is to be a homeless straight child?
Oh, very much so.
Why?
They're obligated to physical, mental, sexual abuse. They're up to do crime, take drugs, especially for our trans youth. I think the trans youth, for the most part, have to deal with homelessness more than just LGBT youth, just because of their sexual orientation. Like if they're born a male and identify as a female, they're more apt to victimization, and misgendering.
Mm.
Streets.
What happens to kids, Brennan, who come to you because you're known as a safe place for kids, and there are safe signs that are coded all over the city? You can go to a place and they'll take you to the Relatives because it's known among young people about this. What happens to those kids that you simply can't hang on to? I mean, you can't hang on to them if they're 15 years old for the next 5 years. What happens to them? What do you do to them for them? Where do you send them?
Well, we have lots of partners in the community. One primary partner is Youth and Family Services, and so they're a support for a lot of the younger youth, those youth under 18.
But how difficult is it to find foster homes or place these kids in safe environments when they are gay or trans? And that's difficult. If it's difficult for their parents, how difficult is it for foster parents, et cetera?
I think it's very difficult. But I also believe that our community has a pretty strong network of supports that can help our young adults or youth and young adults who need those unique services. And, still, we don't have enough. We don't have enough resources, clearly. But there are some supports for those young kids. And when those kids turn 18 and start to transition, that's really where we have a major issue because they're now adults.
How helpful is the adult gay community in helping these kids? Are they reluctant to intervene, reluctant to discuss, or are they open to this? Are they welcoming to this because they've been through this in their earlier lives themselves, perhaps?
I feel like there's a lot of discussion in the adult gay community about the issue. I feel like, unfortunately, we've been focused on issues that affect the middle class LGBT community, like marriage equality. It's much easier to grasp this marriage concept than it is to deal with the uncomfortable reality of people's children on the street. I am formerly homeless. I was homeless at 18. Fortunately, I dealt with the New York City homelessness system. So there were resources specifically designed for me as a young gay man to attain stability. There's a lack of that here.
So they have a better system set up in New York.
Oh, absolutely. And I think we'd be wise to look to cities like New York and LA for best practice models of something that we could implement locally. There's a resource in New York City called the Ali Forney Center. It was just launched, I think, in like 2002. They have an amazing program, an amazing success rate. They have a transitional housing program where all of their residents are employed and half of them are in college. I think we have to look to organizations like that who are doing it and it's working for them,
right,
and see how we can make it work here in Charlotte.
Actually, the New York statistic that you tell me, that it's actually better for kids who are homeless and gay in New York than it is here. It's kind of scary because nationally statistics say that homeless gay kids are 7 times more likely than their straight counterparts to be victims of a crime, and often a violent crime at that, and 3 times more likely to engage in what is commonly called survival sex, for which shelter is the payment, not cash. I read a bunch of stories yesterday that actually it never even entered my mind. But kids who are starving and homeless will go to bed with somebody just to have a bed to sleep in that night.
Oh, yeah. And I'm glad you said that, because the face of homelessness in this community is not just an adult face. And a lot of our kids are doing just sometimes unimaginable things to make sure that they can have food to eat and a place to sleep. And those youth who identify as LGBTQ are really twice, maybe 3 times as likely to be victims when, or more victimized when they're engaging in those types of practices.
And also, it causes an increase in the occurrence of AIDS.
AIDS,
absolutely. Of HIV.
Of HIV, absolutely.
Homeless youth often, I'm told, quickly turn to crime to support themselves, because you'd have to eat to survive, and many times that crime is prostitution. What does that do to rising incidences of HIV?
I definitely think it's a contributing factor. I think homeless, gay, and trans and queer youth are something like 3 or 4 times more likely to acquire HIV, actually. It's exponentially more likely. And then there is the HIV/AIDS organization like RAIN that comes in to meet that particular need, but we can't meet the housing need.
Right.
We're removed from that process altogether. We have no input. So
we're the 16th largest city in the country, and you just mentioned, Francisco, a few minutes ago that we're 14th in the nation in the infection rate of HIV, with young gay men of color disproportionately affected. Why? Why is it young gay men of color?
You know, it's about behavior patterns. Young gay men of color tend to be sexually intimate with other young gay men of color, so it's sort of a numbers game. I think that there's a lack of wraparound services. When you have a homeless black young gay man, let's say 18 years old, and he goes to the shelter and he's facing discrimination there because of his sexual orientation and if he's already positive because of his HIV status, and then there's like a lack of care coordination and wraparound services to make sure that all of his basic needs are met.
Mm-hmm.
I think that contributes to the prevalence.
So what are we doing or not doing here that gives us the ranking of 14th in the nation for this?
You know, I don't even know how to answer that question. I mean, I think we're doing great with prevention and awareness. I think HIV is definitely a disease of behavior. So how do you change behavior and how do you eliminate like institutional barriers and things like that?
When you go back and talk, in the cases where you have an opportunity to go back and talk to parents who have told their children to leave because of their orientation, and you bring these things up, the things that we've been talking about, the violent crime, susceptibility to violent crime, the need to support themselves in any way they can, which includes survival sex. If you're a religious parent, what does that – how does that impact these parents?
It takes a while for folks to accept it, and many just don't. And so when that happens, we have to identify ways to make sure that the kids still can be safe going forward and be prepared as independent adults. At The Relatives, we have a program called OnRamp that works with 16 to 24-year-olds. We have about 600 young adults a year coming through that program, and about 40% of them are homeless. A major portion of those young kids do identify as LGBTQ. And so we have to make sure that we provide holistic services to prepare them to make sure that they have the education and employment and then the housing to be safe going forward.
Time Out Youth is not a shelter. Never has been. Is it a shelter?
It's not.
It's not.
It's not.
So what kind of things do you do for these young people?
The Wholesome program is designed for kids that have been displaced from their home because of their sexual orientation, and as a result, they're homeless. What we do is find volunteers that are willing to open their home for a short period of time mm-hmm. to house these kids. It could be just emergency purposes, like 1 or 2 days or 1 or 2 months. And after that, we start to go into case management and job preparation. And
Atlanta seems to be ground zero for the homeless gay population in this part of the country, but they only have 8 beds at their shelter there, Lost and Found Youth in Atlanta. They have 8 beds. And there are about 750 LGBTQ homeless young people in Atlanta on average. Where does Charlotte fall? How many people are here in that situation?
Charlotte is not even tracking. That's one of the issues. Yeah. We know that this is a nationwide crisis, and we know that it has local implications, but we're not even doing the necessary work on the ground. We're not even tracking these youth. In fact, I challenge every organization who had a representative here today to track these youth over the next year and get a definite figure, like a definite calculable figure of the need. So,
okay. Well, we'll have to leave it at that, and because I wish we could get into what we do about this problem, but we don't have any more time to do that, I'm sorry to say. Brennan Graham is Executive Director of The Relatives. Francisco White, the peer navigator with Empowering Positive Youth at the Carolina Regional AIDS Interfaith Network, and Shakira Clark, Director of Youth Services for Time Out Youth. Thanks for being here.
Charlotte talks with